Hey, super fans, you can join Terry, Terry Farrell, the Trexperts in Outer Space, as we make the trek to the greatest Star Trek locations of all time. Everywhere in the known universe, along with a galactic gaggle of Trek and sci-fi celebrities. How much constitutes a gaggle?
Well, at least two or three.
I have never bothered to calculate it.
Well, pre-production has already begun, but you can get some great backer rewards and help us get production going this summer by joining us at MakeTheTrek.com today. That's MakeTheTrek.com. And check out everything you can do to support the Trexperts and Terry Farrell as we boldly go to the greatest Trek locations of all time. We may even tell you what God needs with the starship. Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
This is Darren Doctorman.
And this is Ashley Miller.
And we are the Inglorious
Trexperts. And that means we're experts on Star Trek.
Does it now?
Well, you know what? But people, I love when they come to us with the trivia. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, tell us, you know, in episode 63, you know, this thing, why did the Enterprise not able to go to warp because of that? I'm like, we don't know anything about that. We're experts on the how the show
was
made.
We're experts on the show.
Yeah exactly.
We're not
exactly
the goddamn engineer.
Yeah. And speaking of the show, I mean, even though this won't air for a couple of weeks after, our deepest condolences to the family of Robert Butler, yep, a true legend who passed away. Of course, Robert Butler directed the Star Trek pilot, The Cage, but the Batman pilot, Moonlighting, Remington Steele. He was on the podcast a year or two ago. Extraordinary guest,
yeah,
and an extraordinary man. And I have to tell you guys, this was crazy. I was doing a little work on the a little prep on our documentary that we're doing about our travels to the locations of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I really want to get us in a room again with Robert Butler to talk about what it was like shooting The Cage, especially with the 60th anniversary coming up,
right,
and doing a new interview. And I'm like, you know, figuring out how we want to do that. And if maybe we'd bring him to where the sets used to be, to those sound stages and everything. And I literally finished doing my notes on that. And I open up my browser and says Robert Butler has passed away. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, this is not the kind of effective dreaming I want to, I mean, I felt like, you know, George Orr in a horrible way. It's like when he say, oh, bring about world peace and the aliens invade.
Yeah.
Right. Terrible.
Be careful
terrible
what you wish for. You may get it.
Yeah. And speaking of that, now here's another person who passed away. I don't know if you heard this. And I didn't even know he was still alive. Stephen Candell passed away today.
Yeah, I thought he had passed away years ago.
So did I. I mean, we would have had him on the show if I knew he was. It was totally an Abe Vigoda thing.
Right.
Because I thought Stephen Candell had died years ago, but apparently he was living happily in Boston, and he just passed away. Stephen Candell, of course, wrote Mud's Women and was involved in the writing of I, Mud, and I believe also Mud's Passion, if I'm not mistaken. And worked in television for many years, obviously beyond Star Trek as well, created his own shows. But really sad because we're really in the end game for the original series. Yeah. There's so few people left who worked on the original series. And it's sad because
absolutely.
That's why it's important to have a show like Trexperts is preserving the legacy, I feel.
We're like the preservers.
Yeah.
We're like preservers?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, very, very, very much like that. So today, this is interesting. Maybe it's not really that interesting, but the plumber was at the house today. And, the plumber knows I'm a Star Trek fan. He goes, you know, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I was at one of those Star Trek actors' houses. A really nice lady. And I said,
the toilet was clogged.
Was it Gates? I don't know what. No, it was a sink problem. And I said, Gates McFadden? No, it was a Marina. No, turns out it was Nana Visitor after we played. And he said, and I said, oh, we love Nana. You know her? And I'm like, yeah, we love Nana. She's great. She was in Deep Space Nine. And he goes, is that a good show? It's like, yeah, it's a really good show. Yeah, and she was really good in it. You might want to check it out. He goes, yeah, because I don't like those new Star Treks. I said,
wow. But it was all unsolicited.
It's, you know, it's 30 years old and more than that. And he said, oh, yeah, I got to check that out because she seemed really nice. I said, well, was this recent? He goes, no, probably about 10 years ago. I was like, what?
but he remembers it.
You see, Potters have a much longer range of memory than most people do.
But it was funny because he said to me, he said, yeah, she had a bad leak. She said, oh, I'm not sure you can be able to find it. And he said, I looked and immediately said, oh, here's where the leak is. She said, how do you know? He goes, because I'm a plumber. How do I know? He said, I don't tell you how to act. She's like, I don't think you're going to be able to find the leak. It's very hard. He just found it in 3 seconds.
Is that actually how he sounded? Was that a representation of his voice?
Not at all. Not at all.
Because that's exactly how I imagined his voice would be.
No, but the funny thing about him is he's also a poet. So whenever he comes over.
But does he know it?
Oh, he knows it. Because he always wants to read his plumbing poetry to me whenever he comes to the house.
Is it shit?
And no, it's good, but it's kind of like, you know, let's get on with it. You know, I got things I got to do.
The pipe not taken.
Anyway, so enough about the plumber. He was actually here to put in a new water filter because my wife is concerned about the all the stuff, the chemicals and forever chemicals and stuff in water. So he put in a new filter for our refrigerator water filter. So. Hopefully
well, you have to have clean water to put your little packets in.
That's right, that's right. By the way,
and you never know when you might need to put out the I-10.
Speaking of voices, we have a terrific guest today. It's Susan Sackett. Susan Sackett, for 17 years, she was the assistant to Gene Roddenberry. She started with him right after the Questor tapes. And wrote a very famous Starlog column about the making of the Star Trek movies, the book Letters to Star Trek. But one imitation or one voice that you do not hear on the podcast today, most surprisingly, is Gene Roddenberry. Gene, why didn't you show up?
Well, you know, I think that the reason why I didn't make an appearance during the interview is I think that let her have her own voice for a change. She was always speaking for me and with me, and I think it would have been a little too much to sort of bring that up again. And I told Darren absolutely no doing of the Gene Roddenberry voice during the interview. But as you see, I'm not shy, and I will make an appearance when I wish to. Anyway, that's my simple reason.
Yeah. Well, I think that it was great having Susan on the show. She wrote a really interesting book. I haven't read in a couple of years. It was called Inside Trek: My Secret Life with Star Trek Creator Gene Roddenberry. And what's interesting about the book is she goes into a great deal of detail about it, both her professional and personal relationship with Gene. It's no secret that she had a romantic involvement affair with Gene. And there's some great stuff I hadn't heard before in that book. But then there's also a lot of details about their affair. And I got to say, it was pretty ballsy of her to include some of the details that she did. And I'm not sure, we didn't really discuss, it may be the first time I sort of shied away from it. So, you know, normally I go where the angels fear to tread. I don't care. I'll ask anybody anything.
Yeah.
I didn't get into some
of
the subjects.
You made a conscious effort not to get
to avoid about talking about some of that because, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a private thing, but she made it public by including in her memoir some of the gory details. But I admire the audacity of it. And you know,
yeah, and if you're interested, buy her book.
That's right.
Absolutely, it's very.
That's what it's for.
And I have to say, I think the book is quite good. You know, a lot of people. What's interesting is we know a lot of people have written Star Trek who are peripherally involved, who don't necessarily really have great insights. She was there for a long time and has some, I think, great stories about the early days of Next Generation and wrote it, you know, back when I think this was a lot more fresh in her mind. Right. And I think it's a good book. I got to tell you, I was reading Letters to Star Trek, which I haven't really cracked open probably in 40, 50 years.
Right.
And I found a passage I found was particularly apt. This is Gene Roddenberry explaining the appeal of Star Trek. Really, Darren should be reading this, but I think Star Trek was a first in television, having a mixed international crew of various colors and ideas and cultures and philosophies. It just seemed to me most implicitly obvious that if mankind makes it into the next century, all of those things that divide us, color, race, religion, culture, and so on, can no longer divide us. Petty nationalism has got to go. We will not make it unless we have begun to cherish the differences between people instead of being afraid of them. I think variety gives life a lovely quality. Irishmen and Jews and Blacks and Asians all bring a fascinating kaleidoscope of wonderful things. It just seemed obvious to me that that's what we at Star Trek had to do. Now, this isn't anything he hasn't said before, but I think it's particularly apt during these troubled days to remind people of what was at the heart of the DNA of Star Trek.
Absolutely. And we're still not there. We're not even close.
Yeah. If anything, no. we've taken some steps back.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of steps back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sadly.
Well, yeah, it's true. What do they say? One step forward, two steps back. And we've definitely taken two steps back from that Star Trek future. But as the expression goes, it's always darkest before the dawn, and we can only hope that things will take a turn for the better in the coming months, years, decade. But this was an extraordinary book. It was such interesting books because Star Trek books were selling so well, and you got to remember the James Blish stuff had adapted all the stuff, the Alan Dean Foster log books. Adapted all. So there wasn't really a lot of new content. So anything they could come up with, I mean, it's literally a book of letters to Star Trek.
Right.
It's letters that people wrote telling Gene and company how much they love Star Trek. So
it's like one of our letters episodes.
Totally. And I'm amazed. I'm amazed I actually bought this book. But, and yet I have it all these years later. I mean, nearly 50 years later from when it was published, I still have this book. You know, with all the places I've lived and moved and stuff.
It's a good painting on the cover. It's a nice cover.
It's a really nice cover, isn't it?
It's a good cover, and thorough.
And then, you know, she also wrote at that time, Star Trek Speaks, which was basically just an amalgamation of quotes from the series. It was basically the equivalent of what would be a web page now. Right. But that was also a popular book. It's funny because, she doesn't remember this. But she, after the making of Star Trek, she was supposed to write the visual effects of Star Trek, the motion picture, right? But because that was such a disaster, and because the publishing line didn't do as well as they hoped, they canceled it. She conflates that with her book, Star Trek, the first 25 years, and says, oh, no, I think you have it confused. No, actually, she was confused because it was two separate books, the special effects book.
Well, let's talk about that after.
Yeah, okay. We'll talk about that after. We'll talk about that after. But I think she tells some really interesting stories.
Absolutely.
And we're about to share those with you. This is Gene Roddenberry's assistant, Susan Sackett, who was with him for so many years. And literally the person who many of us, the first things we hear about Star Trek, the motion picture, or what the future of Star Trek came through Susan. So she was a very important and well-known person to a lot of us who grew up in the 70s, who were anxious for news about what was going on with Star Trek. So without any further ado, let's bring in Susan Sackett to talk Trek archaeology.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Trexperts are back on the road again as We're back, baby. The Inglorious Live Tour continues in 2024. And we're visiting some great cities near you. So don't miss a chance to get exclusive Trexperts merchandise, autographed posters, and see us moderate conversations with the biggest stars in the Trek universe coming to a galaxy or at least a city near you this year, including Richmond, Virginia, Anaheim, California for WonderCon, Oklahoma City, May 24th through 26th, San Diego, California for Comic-Con with Mark and Ashley, July 24th to 28th. But if Mark and Ashley aren't your cup of tea, well, where are they going to find you, Darren?
Well, I'm going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina, July 25th through 28th. Me only. Wow. It's the Trexpert tour.
You get Darren all to yourself.
Yeah,
and
right.
Then we'll all be reuniting, and it feels so good, in San Jose, California, August
16th
to the
18th.
I know the way to San Jose. And maybe we'll go up north to look for the nuclear vessels while we're there. Well, and we're bringing it on all home in Columbus, Ohio, December 6th to the 8th. So if you want to know what guests will be joining us and how to get tickets, go to galaxycon.com, comic-con.org, or trexpertsplus.com. You'll be glad you did. We'll see you around the galaxy.
Join us
next year.
Saturday, can DJ Hooker stop a corrupt politician from terrorizing teenage runaways? Then a special Valentine cruise has everyone falling in and out of love on the love boat. And a dream to be queen.
Caesar!
Turns to off with her head on Fantasy Island.
You shall all die.
Trapped on a strange landmass, they come from different times, but they're all in danger now.
Use whatever means necessary.
An unearthly swamp and an android colony with a human leader await on the Fantastic Journey. Roddy McDowall joins the Fantastic Journey Thursday at 8, 7 Central and Mountain.
Next time, on an all-new episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, passion has its price.
Are you my father?
Why did you not tell me?
A dark past threatens a new generation.
He would be an outcast. Another traitor from a family of traitors.
And when Klingon pride is wounded...
As my son, he would also bear my disgrace.
Worf must avenge his family honor in an all-new episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. Saturday at 7 on WTIC Fox 61.
Well, welcome, Susan. You have had quite the illustrious history for many years with... the Star Trek franchise, among other things. One of the ways that's interesting, I think no two people have been better about celebrating the sort of legacy, Gene's legacy specifically, than you and Rod, at Rod Roddenberry. And I think it's so important because as new generations discover Star Trek, they're not as familiar with not only the ethos, but you know how important Gene was. What an amazing achievement. What creative ferment existed during those heady days? You know, when you joined with him in 1974, it was the beginning of this new era of Star Trek, which wouldn't exist today had it not been for those next 20 years. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of your feelings about the importance of Gene and what he leaves behind to this next generation, so to speak?
Sure. And thanks for that nice welcome. You know, so many people, now that Gene's no longer here, have attempted, not too recently, but now and then, to claim credit for, I was the one that created Star Trek. Well, I was the one that took it to Desilu, or I was the one that did this. Right. And, you know, if it hadn't been for Gene, there would be no Star Trek. Gene was the one that persevered and continued to pursue this. He was the one that set the ground rules for how it should go. And, you know, people failed to understand that it was his dream, and the fact that he put his stamp on it and said, this is the way it's going to be. And, you know, then others have come along and tried to claim that it's their legacy. And it really bothers me, because if it wasn't for Gene, I mean, Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek are synonymous. You can't claim that it was created by this person or that person or this director of the film or whatever. And so maintaining his legacy has been vital, and Rod is doing that. And whenever I can, I will always speak positively about him, because that was the person that I knew.
And well, they say success has many fathers, failure is an orphan. You don't see her. You didn't see Herb Solo taking credit for Pretty Maids All in a Row, did you?
No,
but Star Trek, on the other hand.
Yeah. Herb would like to think he was the one that saved it. And that's just really not true. And neither is it, you know, the the child of, and I don't want to name a lot of names, but recent producers, people that did the spinoffs that came after Star Trek, film directors, film producers, they all claim that they were the ones that saved Star Trek. Well, guess what? Nobody is going to be remembered for Star Trek except Gene Roddenberry. And that's just the way it goes. You know, keep trying, people, but you're not going to do it.
That's fair. And especially since, you know, when it was down, there was a comeback, you know, several times. And it's really fascinating to sort of trace the history of it from the 60s up till even now, that you know, it was something that lightning was caught in bottle several times, which was is fascinating.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that they thought about when Next Generation came along. You know, could we catch lightning in a bottle twice? Yeah. Well, not to put down any of the spin-offs, movies, whatever, there have been several really good incarnations and reincarnations, if you want, that have taken place. I'm especially pleased to see Strange New Worlds, which I think captures the essence of the original series, and Next Generation, of course, which I worked on, and a few of the movies. But, you know, some of them I would not say were lightning or even thunder.
light mist, barely precipitation. So tell us about going to work for Gene in 74. Were you someone who was familiar with Star Trek? You had already had a quite a career. You worked in marketing. You'd been a teacher. You'd done a lot. Was Star Trek and Gene Roddenberry on your radar when you got this job working for the quote-unquote Great Bird?
Not necessarily on my radar, but it was something that, you know, one can only dream about. I had been working at NBC with the commercial division there and the unit managers and whatnot. And then I had another job somewhere else. And then I was in an auto accident and I had a really bad whiplash and I didn't have a job. I was collecting unemployment for like 8 months. And my very good friend, Fred Bronson, who has always come through for me and we worked together later as writing partners and whatnot, heard that there was an opening at Lincoln Enterprises working in the catalog branch that Majel was running and suggested that I apply for it. And I did. And she said, well, you're too, not talented, but, you know, overqualified. One of those lovely words that you hear all the time.
To run my mail order company.
Right. No, not to run it, just to, you know, be an employee, ship out this clip and that, whatever. And so she said, but my husband needs somebody because his secretary from Warner Brothers, he had been, Gene had been doing something at Warner Brothers. I forget which one of those.
Was that Quester Planet tapes? Earth,
was it Quester? Okay. No, I don't think it was Quester. I think that was Universal.
Oh, Planet Earth, maybe.
Maybe. But anyway, his secretary didn't want to, Gene was working out of his house because he had no projects. So everything was completed.
He was ahead of his time, Susan. Now everyone works out of their houses. But
That's true. So Ralph wanted to go back to Warner Brothers. He had a pension, blah, blah. And I thought he was nuts because he could work for Gene Roddenberry. Okay. So Gene needed somebody and I happened to be there and it was his birthday. I went in and interviewed with him and he took my resume. He stuck it in the desk drawer and never read it. We just chatted and he said, you're hired. Can you start like tomorrow? And I said, sure. And I did. And that was it. It was August 19th, 1974. Wow. And it's his birthday.
And that was some house. You never needed to see each other if you were working there. It was so big, that Bel Air house.
No, this wasn't Bel Air, though. This was in Truesdale Estates on the borderline with Beverly Hills. And it wasn't that huge. I mean, it had a rising atrium. And when you entered, it was probably 20 feet high. But the rooms were all around it. And his office and my office were not together, but they were, you know, like a few steps away from each other. And, you know, it was nice. I liked working up there. It was quiet, maybe a little too quiet. I had hoped to be working at a studio.
Right.
And, you know, eventually we did move on to the Paramount lot in 1975, and we were going to do a movie or a TV series or something. It took 4 years, but we got there eventually.
It's so funny that that felt like an eternity back then. But now when you think about it, 4 years, it's, you know, it's barely a drop in the bucket for many franchises these days. Now, were you a fan? You mentioned it was exciting to go work for Gene. You were a fan of the show at the time?
You know, he asked me that question when I was interviewing, and I said, yeah, I've seen it. I was a raving fan. I was such a big fan that when I arrived in Los Angeles, I had been working in Miami as a teacher, and I came out to L.A. and taught school for a year. And my dream was to work in show business since I was 8 years old. And so when I got there, I started applying. I quit teaching. I applied to you know, NBC or whatever, ended up getting a job there. But my dream was to at least visit the Star Trek sets. Well, the day that I arrived, I think, was when it was canceled. And I never got to go there. But yes, sure, I was a fan. I was. I wrote letters. I, you know, did everything I could to try to keep it on the air when they canceled it. So even from Miami, I said, it's the 5-year mission. This has only been 3 years.
We're owed 2 years.
Yeah.
And you were there for the tail end of the animated series. Obviously, Fred did an episode of that under a pseudonym. Right. Was that something, did that satiate your desire for more Star Trek at the time? Do you recall? Or was
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but, or was it something that, It felt not substantial enough for you?
No, it was fine. It was canceled. Just about after I think it was canceled even before I went to work for Gene. It was, you know, off the air. So, or it was in the final stages, whatever. So no, it was a good series. I enjoyed it. And I would never, I think most people discount it because it was so short lived.
Right.
And but it was good Star Trek. DC Fontana was in charge and she kept it on track. And the stories were good. The canon, I think, was pretty much upheld. I haven't seen these in a long time.
Sure.
Some cassettes I'm going to look at one of these days. But so no, there was nothing new in the Star Trek world at that time, except for all the people that wanted to see it come back, and it went into syndication, and it was doing really well in syndication. And so at Paramount decided, hey, wait, we've got this project or this property, and we need to put it in together in some form. And they were going to start a new network,
right?
Which was going to be the fourth. There were only three networks at the time, NBC, ABC, and CBS. And Paramount said, oh, we're going to start the fourth network. It's going to be the Paramount Network. We need a flagship program. And that was going to be a return of Star Trek. And, you know, it kicked around. I talk about this a lot in one of my books. And I wrote for Starlog magazine for 4 years. And I kept, you know, like a trained seal, kept that ball in the air forever. It's coming back. Oh, it's going to be here. It's going to be a wonderful movie. Oh, it's going to be a new TV series. And eventually it happened. But 4 years back then was a long time. Now, you know, 4 years ago was just pre-pandemic. It was, seems like those 4 years have flown by.
People forget without, you know, long before the internet, what that was like. You were like the sole source of information for people reading that Starlog column where, and every month, I mean, I can't imagine with the lead time, things would change so quickly by the time your column would come out. It's a movie. It's a TV show. It's a movie. And you had to give information without really giving any information. And I wonder what that was like for you, because of course you couldn't really say anything, but at the same time, it felt like substantial, even though it wasn't.
Well, as I say, it was like keeping the ball in the air. I would talk about, oh, they just completed building the sets. Well, the sets could have gone for TV or movie or whatever. We did finally get a bigger budget, but, oh, we've hired so-and-so to be the writers. And now we've got a new producer. You know, I think the lead time was maybe 4 weeks, if that much. And so it was enough to not be too out of date by the time it the presses, but you know, things that you could write about that were going to be the same, like the sets are beautiful and
we're so excited about our director Bob Collins. Oh wait.
Yeah, really, there were so many possible directors. And writers and then it's going to be a TV series, and we're getting scripts in, and you know, those ended up in the vault and came in handy during the last writer's strike, which was, I don't know, 30 something years ago.
Yeah, right, during the Next Gen, where they reused some of the scripts from Phase 2. What were your feelings? Because you dealt with him a little bit, and he started as a fan of Gene's and then became sort of a nemesis, so to speak, was Harold Livingston. What a curmudgeon. I mean, a real character.
I liked him. There are a lot of egos in Hollywood. Everybody thinks that they are the most important part of whatever the project is. I'm the one that's making it happen. Everybody kowtow to me. Well, Harold did a lot of writing, and Gene, would often give the benefit of the doubt to somebody, but if they acted, imperious about it, that could become a problem. But all in all, I liked Harold a lot. He had worked in other things, but he had worked in the Israeli Air Force at one time. And, so we had a lot of things to talk about. He didn't have a book out at the time, and I didn't. He was jealous of me because I had written a book. He always wanted to have a book in print. Here's this man who had written all this wonderful stuff, and he wanted a book. So we had a lot to talk about, and I enjoyed him.
Right. That was a tumultuous time, certainly as we look back at it now. What was it like the day to day of dealing with them shooting on the stage and the machinations in the background with the script rewrites and constant updating? That couldn't have been a peaceful environment.
I was not a writer. I was Gene's assistant, so. Yeah. I was not in the throes of all of this stuff going on. So, I mean, there were pages coming in daily, and the actors were not thrilled because they had to re-memorize new dialogue that they hadn't seen before, and they came in different colors every day. You know, you start out with all white script, and then you go to blue pages. Okay, so we have some blue pages. Then you go to pink pages. Then you go to yellow pages, and so on and so forth. And then they were being handed pages as they were about to go on camera.
Right.
So it was a bit chaotic, especially for the writers. The staff, I think, just kind of was not too happy about it, and there was some conflict. But we're talking about something that was 50 years ago almost,
That's crazy.
It's hard to recall all of the hazari that went on.
Oh, I'm sure. I just feel sorry for the Xerox technician that had to keep up with the machine.
I don't know where they did these things. No, they weren't mimeographs.
No.
You didn't just walk the walk, but Gene didn't just walk the walk. He talked the talk in terms of being someone who was open to new technology. You were one of the first people to work on a personal computer, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. We got something that was, it was a step up from the old Commodore 64, I think. It was called a Lexor Writer. And it was a combination of typewriter and computer. And you had to put in the memory. It had no memory of its own. So you had a disk and you had to insert that. And Gene was just thrilled because he loved being on the cutting edge of any kind of technology.
Sure.
Me, not so much. The first day that we got these, I ended up with a stomach ache and had to go home. It was just too intense for me. But Gene got that. And then later, I'm not sure which person from Apple, but one of the head honchos sent him, what were the early app? This was all contained in a box. But I'm not
sure. Yeah, the Lisa, first.
The Which first one? Macintosh was all contained.
Yeah, it might have been a Mac, but it was, you know, Gene was so excited. And then eventually, yeah. you know, he would get bigger and better. And this one has 20 megabytes of memory or whatever. He was just thrilled with all of that.
Well, one of our friends was a writer at Paramount and at the time. And he says that one day he saw Gene basically hanging out his window, shouting at people about this wonderful word processor that he had. And he was showing it off. And it's just such a lovely story of his enthusiasm over things like that.
I don't doubt it. He was thrilled with all of the new technology. He just loved it. And you know, if he could have, he probably would have waved it out the window and said, look what I have.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know, that sounds exactly like him. Anybody who came in the office, let me show you my new toy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he always kept up with the latest technology if he could. Yeah.
Long before the age of sort of the celebrity showrunner like Vince Gilligan and so many of these people mm-hmm. now, you people back then, people didn't know who wrote their television. Maybe they knew like a Jack Webb because he was on camera, but Gene was somebody that people knew. They would go see him speak. They knew his name. So he had this entourage of really eclectic, interesting people that were in your orbit. And I just love the fact that like somebody like Paul McCartney would be somebody that you would meet. Can you tell us what that was all about?
Paul, yeah, Paul, Sir Paul. He wasn't Sir then. Paul contacted Gene. He was a fan. And he was with Wings at that time. It was past the Beatles. And he wanted to do a film, and he thought Gene could help. Paul sent Gene sort of an outline, and I hope Rod found it somewhere, but it was going to be about this band in space is about all I remember of it. And I don't really remember it, but when Paul came to town, town being Los Angeles, he invited Gene to a performance of Wings, and his band and Linda was there, and it was just fantastic. And we all went backstage, and I got to speak with him and meet him, and it was just sitting around having some Coke and Pepsi or whatever, and. Just enjoying life with Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney. And one time, Gene was doing something called Spectre in England in between projects. And I was privileged to be able to fly over and work on that a little bit. And I answered the phone one time and it was Paul. He goes, hi, this is Paul McCartney. Is Gene there? And I, oh yeah, hold on, please don't. Yeah. You know, like an idiot. But I mean, that I think, you know, the project would have been weird, but he turned out to be a fan. They're everywhere. I mean, Isaac Asimov, of course, Gene was in touch with, and Arthur C. Clarke, and just all, you know, people that you, if you're into this sort of thing, these were just pals and friends. And he had a lot of high-tech people working on various things from Cal State and or Caltech rather, and the Rand Corporation. And he got experts to work on Star Trek, and he would get their opinions. And even Isaac Asimov, he ran things by him. So, right. You know, these were like everyday names to me. I at first, you know, I was like, wow. And then it's like, okay, Isaac Asimov's on, you know, mm-hmm. line one.
Well, the first time I ever heard of Jesko von Puttkamer was in this little chestnut that you wrote, Letters to Star Trek, which was a book that came out in 1976, which amuses me to no end because I thought this was the greatest thing in the world at the time. And, you know, it's basically a compilation in 1977, your first book of what would become many. It's a compilation of letters you received at the office. What was the impetus for this? I mean, the idea and then selling it to Bantam?
Yeah, Ballantyne, which was, I think, owned by Random House, but I'm not sure at that time. Anyway, we had sacks and sacks of mail that were being delivered, fan mail. Right. And they ended up, they would go to Lincoln Enterprises and they would end up, this was when we were working out of the house, and they were being tossed. Just, you know, if there was something in there, somebody sent a check because they wanted to buy something from Lincoln, fine. If not, toss the letter. And I started looking at some of these and I went, these are amazing. And they were not at first from famous people. They were just from the fans asking, you know, this and that. And they were so interesting that it occurred to me that they could be put together into some kind of a book. And so I contacted Valentine and Gene backed me up with support to put these together into a book. Well, and there were some things that we wanted to, I think it was the editor that said, we need a little bit more to sell this. So let's see, you know, what other mail you have that you can add to this. So we had stuff that came into the office from, it's been a while since I looked at the book, but I think there's things in there from famous people, including, mm-hmm. you mentioned Jesko von Puttkamer. And there might be something in there from Isaac Asimov, I'm not positive, but, and, you know, things like that. So we had a lot of fun putting this together and we got some pictures and I still, every now and then I get a copy that I pick up somewhere because it's been out of print, you know, for ages.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Sold close to 100,000 copies originally.
That's huge.
And, yeah, it is huge. And it was very exciting. And there was never another edition of it. So if you have one, hang on to it. But
absolutely. Well,
it's so fun that because of that book and your columns later on, that you created a direct connection with the fans, you know, so that the fans could see a little of the behind the scenes goings on and to see the sort of human beings behind the whole thing. And that was something that was extremely rare, but it was really nice.
Yeah, I stayed in touch with a lot of the fans and they had clubs in Australia and England and around the country. There are some people that I'm still in touch with, a lady named Janet Corton who lives in Scotland. And I've actually visited these people and they were generous enough to invite me to stay in their homes. Mm-hmm. I visited Australia and met some people there. And so it, you know, it was, and Eric Stillwell, I don't know if everybody sure. knows his name, but he was a teenager at the time. I went to, he was living somewhere in Oregon and I was promoting a book about game shows, I think, that I had written. And Eric had been a president of a big fan club, even as a teen, he was involved with Star Trek. And so he came out to greet me at the hotel in Portland and they wouldn't let him sit with us in the bar because he was underage.
Right.
So that was my first meeting with Eric. Eric now, of course, is well known.
For those of you who don't know, Eric was a co-writer on Yesterday's Enterprise and then worked on Next Generation as a member of the staff.
Yeah.
Yeah. He started as Michael Piller's assistant, I believe.
Yeah. And he worked with him after Star Trek too for a while. And Eric is now retired to the south of France.
Yeah.
Eric and his wife. Yeah, so there were a lot of fan clubs and whatnot where I got to meet people through that. I'm trying to think of others. There's such a big group of fans out there still. I have
it's a unique community, isn't it?
I get in touch with a lot of them. I have a Facebook page and there are so many Facebook groups of fans, and I'm always promoting something. I have a shameless promotion here. I have an eBay store called Inside Trek, and you can buy some of the things that I've collected over the years. We're getting down to not as many, but things like scripts. The scripts, I think, have all been sold. There's some books. There are flyers. This week I've got, I do auctions and I've got a bunch of flyers from FilmCon 1, if anybody remembers that, from 1972.
Wow.
There are, you know, all the guests, Gene was a guest of honor there and I was the celebrity coordinator. I wasn't working for him at that time, so this was very exciting for me. I got to meet him and take him with the blooper reel into the the auditorium and introduce him. And it was just really, really fun. So yeah, there are still lots and lots of fans. But if you want to get a copy of that, you can the book, you can go to Amazon, Kindle, or my store.
Yeah, and the book you're referring to, of course, is your most recent book, which is Inside Trek, My Secret Life with Creator Gene Roddenberry, which is a history of the long 17 years that you spent with Gene,
right.
Both as your boss and as a romantic partner. And there's some great Trek stories, but also some really interesting inside Hollywood insights as well. And you updated it, didn't you? The second edition you updated, including more information.
There's an update in the Kindle edition online. There's only been one printing of the book. Mm. And you can read all the gruesome details.
Well, I think it's great that you it's really candid. And I think so many of the books are, you know, some of the people involved with Star Trek have told over the years are apocryphal, or it's a copy of a story they heard that they repeated at conventions, which has no bearing on the truth. It's really Rashomon. What I like about your stuff is you're there, you know, as a writer, you've chronicled stuff going back to your making of Star Trek, the motion picture book. Now, obviously, there's certain things you couldn't say at the time and you read it now and, you know, but it's a really interesting book. I think both you and Walter are two of the most important contemporaneous accounts of the making of that film.
You're talking about the making of Star Trek,
the motion picture. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I had to adhere to certain preordained ways of writing because Paramount licensed this.
Right.
And so, for example, and this is recent, you may have seen something about the Enterprise model that had belonged to Gene.
That's correct, yeah.
From that famous photo Fred had taken.
Disappeared. I don't know which photo you're referring to, but...
The one on the desk of Gene.
I took that photo.
Oh, Fred said he did.
Uh-huh.
No, here we go.
Okay. Anyway, I don't know why Freda would have even been there. But anyhow, this was upstairs in Gene's office at the house. So I forgot where I was going with this.
But it was recently rediscovered, yeah.
Oh, right. So, and it does look authentic. That's what's
absolutely
so amazing.
Yeah.
But it disappeared during the filming of the movie.
Right.
And nobody knew what happened to it. Gene used to joke that it was sitting on somebody's coffee table.
Right.
So I couldn't talk honestly about what happened to it we think it was somebody from Robert Abel's company, which no longer exists, so I can say that. And that was the last place it had been because they were going to work with it or copy it or do something.
Right.
And Gene asked for it back and they said, well, we don't have it. Well, where is it? Well, we don't know. You know, so there was like that kind of thing. And I talked a little about that in the book, but I had to be very, very careful. Plus, Robert Abel never produced anything that we could use.
Right.
And I started the chapter by saying the trouble with Robert Abel was that he wasn't. Gene said, no, can't say that. Okay. Well, so I had to be very careful. I couldn't start the chapter that way, but I would have loved to have said that.
Yeah. And I think you weren't able to include the potato story, or were you? I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I read the book. The where they delivered the first shot they delivered was a potato on a stick because they didn't have the Enterprise model ready.
I don't recall that at all.
Yeah,
I don't remember saying that. Maybe that's in someone else's book.
It's hard to keep track, but you were so prolific at the time because not only did you do, you also did Star Trek Speaks, which came out that year. And then you were going to do, and I'm curious how far along you got before they canceled the book, the visual effects of Star Trek, the motion picture, which I imagine would have been fascinating.
Yeah, no, I was never supposed to do that. I was supposed to do the 25th anniversary of Star Trek,
right.
But it wasn't a visual effects. It was just it was all written. I had it was on the presses, ready to roll. We had a cover design. We had, in fact, the first printing of the cover, there were three or four of those. And somebody realized that Leonard Nimoy had not signed off on the use of his image, which is in his contract.
Right.
He had not seen the photos. He didn't know what was going to be in the book. And I kind of got his dander up over that and decided that he wouldn't sign. And so we couldn't print the book, because you can't print a book about 25 years of Star Trek without a picture of Leonard Nimoy slash Mr. Spock.
Yeah.
So it got canceled and broke my heart. But they used a good chunk of it in, I can't remember the name of the book, but it was done a couple of years later.
Yeah, Where No Man Has Gone Before, or something like that.
Yeah.
It was a coffee table book.
That's what ours was supposed to be. And you know, Gene would, of course, get top billing, but it was mostly written by me.
Right. Sure.
And so that never happened. And, you know, but there were a lot of things. We were supposed to, Fred and I were going to write the novelization of the God Thing. Anybody remembers that. That was a script that Gene wrote as a potential movie. I think it was going to be the second film after the first one. And
well, he had developed it in the early 70s. And I think you're conflating the God Thing, which was going to be the original Star Trek movie that Barry Diller killed, with his JFK story, which was was going to be his follow-up to the motion picture. So you were going to do the God Thing though, right?
No, the God Thing was also a potential script that he wrote. And we were going to novelize that, novelization of that. And that kind of didn't happen, because after Gene died, there was, I don't know what happened, but they canceled that. So there were a lot of things that were, you know, a lot of irons in the fire that didn't happen, and some that did.
Well, you turned your attention, which was writing teleplays, because you did two episodes of Next Generation, Menage a Trois, and also created the story for The Game, which I know is one of Darren's favorite episodes.
Yes. Really?
Oh, absolutely. Okay.
Well, Fred and I had a lot more. Good. I'm glad you liked it. We did the stories. The script was done by, I think, Brandon, but I'm not sure. Yeah. Anyhow, so we were pitching stories. And, you know, if you work for Gene Roddenberry, the stakes become... may not be the stakes, but the fact that, you know, you're on the inside, you have to try even harder.
Sure.
To get approval, because, you know, you don't want to look like favoritism. So,
right.
But we were thrilled to be able to get those done. We had some other things that we proposed that did not get done by us, but did get done. We had a holodeck story that didn't get done. We proposed a Western that, they didn't buy, and then they did a Western. We'll never do a Western. And then they did a Western.
Right.
Things like that. So it could be, Hollywood is a tough town. And you can't really complain, because unless it's, you know, ripped off word for word, and then you go into an arbitration with the WGA, because, you know, it's, you'll never eat lunch in this town again kind of thing. So you choose your games.
Choose your battles.
Yeah. Choose your battles. Right.
Well, it must have been very interesting. What a transition, because, you know, in the mid-70s, you go from, you know, working at Gene's house on all these projects that may or may not happen. Then being involved in Star Trek, the motion picture, one of the biggest movies, you know, ever made, certainly at that time, and everything that was, it finally coming to fruition, which must have been amazing. And then to then go through Star Trek coming back in the Next Generation era, which obviously was extraordinary, because people said it couldn't be done. And for the longest time, even Gene didn't think it could or should be done. And then he's successful in bringing it back to television, which is why Star Trek continues to flourish, you know, all these years later. You know, Next Generation was the back on which this was all built.
Yeah. He got a proposal from Paramount. There were some people that they brought in, and they were busy writing a new series. This was before Next Gen. And, you know, it was full of gee whiz, cadets. And it was, he said, this is just hokey. This is awful. I can do better than this. And they said, okay, you're on. And he took them up on the challenge and created Next Generation. And he put together a good team to help. But and the bottom line is he gets the credit for being the overseer on all of this. David Gerald helped. DC Fontana, Dorothy helped. They all had input. But it rests on Gene's shoulders no matter what comes out of it. And so, you know, he rode roughshod over quite a few of the scripts that were coming in and the writers weren't happy. But he wanted it to be his Star Trek. So there was a lot going on that first season. But he brought it back and I think it worked out quite well. It was on for, 7 years? So
Absolutely.
How difficult do you feel it was on, you know, obviously Star Trek was this incredible achievement. Gene had given so much to it. He'd given his health. He'd given all this stuff to Star Trek. When the movies, you pretty much got taken away and, you know, Harv was given the sort of keys to the kingdom and Gene was sort of sidelined. How hard was it for him to sort of deal with that? I mean, he was very gracious publicly, but obviously it was a very difficult time.
It was very difficult for him. It was his baby. It was like, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. He felt, although I think he finally was okay with it, but he felt that, I don't think he and Harv were on the same page all the time, literally and figuratively. And he would have, preferred that he had more control. They kind of made him, executive or whatever, which is, just kind of brushing him aside and saying, you can have this title. And I think it hurt him deeply. On the other hand, it did pay some bills. So I don't know.
They promoted him to a desk job, just like they did to Kirk.
Pretty much. Yeah. He's flying a spaceship from a desk. He would give notes. I mean, he gave notes to Harv and whoever else was writing the script at the time, but he had very little power and I think it hurt him very deeply. He did not show that in public, of course. There's a false narrative about the fact that when Spock is killed off, I think in Star Trek II, the end.
Yep.
That I gave that away at some convention that I broke the news. Susan Sackett said that Spock is going to die. Well, that was not true. And Harv ran with that. I think it was his way of getting back at Gene. Gene was the one that actually said it, but Harv also said it.
Yeah.
So it was not me. I just want to set the record straight on that. Okay.
Well, Gene ultimately got his vindication on Next Gen. But it's interesting. We did an episode a while ago where we did an episode on Gene's notes for Star Trek III, which are phenomenally insightful, that Harv ignored pretty much everything. And we have Harv's notes, which were very kind of dismissive of what Gene was saying. And it would not be wrong to say that movie would be 100 times better had he adhered to many of Gene's notes, which were very perceptive and very smart. And I mean, obviously he knew his creation.
Yeah.
He knew Star Trek.
Yeah. I don't remember the notes particularly, but I do recall the fact that, and Harv gave me credit for it, I came up with the way to bring Spock back by, being on the planet that regenerates people and would have regenerated him. And Harv gave me credit for that. I mean, that's, a big part of that film. All I did was say it verbally. I didn't write it. I didn't make notes. I didn't write a script or anything. But I said, hey, here's how you bring him back. So there was also Leonard Nimoy called me into his office one day and he said, I'm really stuck on something. I need to find something for Spock to be doing that shows that he's thinking. I think, and I don't recall, and I haven't seen the film in years and years and years, but there's something in there where Spock is having all these tests and he has to prove that his mind is back. Right. And I said, well, I can't think of much except he could try to solve this problem. Prove the non-existence of God. You can't prove a negative. And so he didn't think much of that, but that was what I came up with. Anyway, I was flattered that Leonard even considered to ask me. I mean, that was very generous and kind of him. So later on, we didn't get along so well because of the fact that he turned down my book, but that's an earlier part of this broadcast. So
you knew Gene better than virtually anyone. What do you think he would make of Star Trek today, of what's become of his creation? Would he be surprised? Would he be happy? Obviously, you know, he'd be happy to be getting paid for all this. But what would be creatively, what do you think Gene would think about everything that's transpired with his baby?
He always said that after he's gone, others would come along and they would do Star Trek. And he said they would probably do it better than I did. There is no litmus test for which is better or whether it is or isn't. I think he would be astounded at all the various forms that it has taken and how long it's gone on, and it still continues. And they still, to me, I think they're going overboard with too many different versions. But the fact that people watch this, I mean, you know, there's animated and there's the Lower Decks and there's Beyond and the movies and just so many things. But I think cautiously, whoever is planning for more and more and more of this, I think they need to pull it back a little bit and walk it back. I think that there's maybe a little bit too much. After a while, you know, it's like gravy. You keep thinning it out and thinning it out, and there's not going to be anything left.
Well, the studio is acting like an addict. They're just trying to get more and more, blood out of the stone, you know. And I don't blame them, but yeah, I think it's incumbent of them to sort of, you know, parse it out a little more, you know, rather than this onslaught. I agree with you.
Yeah. I got to ask you to wrap up. In these, when you look back at these 17 years you spent working with Gene, what are some of the highlights that come back when you look back fondly on those days? Like, what are the things that make you smile, that make you, you know, that you really treasure when you look back at that time?
Well, working together versus personal life together. Working together would be respecting me, his respect of me, as far as ability to do things, to do a little writing, to be creative, to take my advice. He was ready to have the opening of Next Generation to boldly go where no man has gone before. And I said, no, you have to say where no one. He goes, why? I said, because that's the way things are said these days. You know, he was fine with the original Where No Man, and that's from his generation.
Sure.
So I think that was a big highlight, the fact that I said, no, you have to change that. And so he changed it to Where No One Has Gone Before. And, you know, that was a highlight. I also was able to contribute the name of Geordi's visor because nobody else knew what it stood for. And that was in the opening episode, the first episode when we were going, you know, he said, what are we going to call this thing? And I said, visor, visual instrument and sensory organ replacement. That just popped out of nowhere. So what I loved about working with him is the fact that he respected me and respected my opinion. And that's the highest compliment I've ever been paid in my life from somebody like, you know, like Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah. And of the people that were in your orbit, you know, obviously the people you like, people you did like and then didn't like, who are the people you look back fondly and say, you know, they were obviously no one's ever said a bad word about Dee Kelly. People love Dee, right?
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Who are some of the people you look back at? You're just glad that this adventure in Hollywood gave you the mm-hmm. opportunity to be, you know, have them in your life.
I was very fortunate, and I got along with everybody. And the only problem I had was I tried to get Bill Shatner to interview for the making of the motion picture book. Mm-hmm. And he would say to me, get away from me with that recorder. And it really upset me because I needed him to interview with me. Well, years later, I guess it was 2012, he was putting together the Chaos on the Bridge film, which is weird. But he wanted to interview me, and we got to chatting. And I hadn't had a really high opinion of him until then. And we were talking about, I don't know, but I said, you know, there's one thing that really bothered me. And then I told him about this, and he goes, oh, I'm so sorry. I don't remember. He was a changed person by then. Mm. And I think he has changed quite a bit. We had some great discussions over the telephone when he wanted me to appear in that thing that he made, the Chaos on the Bridge thing. Mm. And he flew me, he flew my partner, he flew us both to California. We had lunch. I was interviewed. Then he flew us home. He had a chauffeur pick us up all out of his own pocket,
right?
Because he wanted to make this, film. And, I had great respect for him after that. And I think he's mellowed with the years. So.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is that, back in those before days, he was responsible for being number one on the call sheet. He had so much pressure to
yeah.
keep the persona of Captain Kirk going and support the projects, he was often, you know, out of his mind and focused on his job. So,
oh sure, absolutely. No, I don't resent it. I don't hold it against him. I was just reminded of that when we were chatting. I said, you know, there was one thing that bothered me, but it was all on his shoulders. He was the lead, and he knew it.
Yeah.
Speaking of memoirs, because we talked about your memoir, Patrick Stewart just came out with one called Making It So. Do you have any thoughts about Patrick? Because obviously Patrick was an actor that Gene had, you know, didn't initially embrace the idea, because in a way the captain is a doppelganger for Gene, and he didn't see him as a balding old man. But what were your feelings about, obviously he went along with it, and obviously that decision was validated, but what were your feelings about Patrick, you know, sort of then and now, or any thoughts about him?
I got along very well with Patrick. And I have a few Patrick stories that I could tell about. I don't know how much time we have, but anyway, there's a lot of, Monday morning quarterbacking. I don't know what you would call it, saying that Gene didn't like Patrick. Well, you know, Gene's not here to defend himself. Gene and Patrick got along fine. I don't understand where this is coming from.
From Patrick. That's the crazy thing.
That's what's so weird. They got along fine. And after Gene accepted Patrick, he would back him 100%.
Yeah.
You know, Patrick had... he was discovered, so to speak, by Robert Justman, who saw him in a play at UCLA and said, wow, there's our captain. And Gene went, I don't want a bald captain. That doesn't make any sense. You know, he wanted the heroic, go get him, you know, Shatner type. And he thought Patrick fit the role very well. So I don't understand, you know, what went on behind the scenes. Maybe they fought over dialogue. I have no clue. Everything that I saw, they get along just fine.
Right.
Quick story. I don't know. Do we have time?
Oh, go ahead. Of course, please.
So Patrick and I were both guests at a con in Alberta, Canada. And it was time to fly home, and we're both on the same plane sitting across the aisle. I mean, I didn't arrange that. It just happened that way. And to fly back to LA, and there's a snowstorm outside. Well, I've never flown in anything but hot Southern California or Southern Arizona, where I am, weather. And I'm looking outside, and, you know, they're de-icing, whatever they do to planes in that weather. And then I look across the aisle, I go, oh, we'll be fine. Captain Picard is over there. You know, everything is well. And I said, oh, it's good to see you there, Patrick. I was afraid, but now I see you. He goes, I'm terrified. I said, no, you can't be. So obviously everything worked out, but
right.
I expected encouragement and support from him and going, oh, we're going to be fine. You know, because I'm terrified.
No false bravado there.
No.
Terrific. Well, Susan, thank you so much for this sort of walk down memory lane. And obviously, if people want to find some of your out of print, as well as the book Inside Trek, which they can get autographed along with a bunch of other stuff depending on the week, they should check out your eBay store. And where can they find that?
Called Inside Trek. That's the name of the store. And there's the book and there's a lot of other things for sale, as I mentioned. So, yeah, and I'm happy to autograph it too.
I've been a previous customer. I bought a couple pieces of stationery, so...
I remember that. Yes, I have some of Gene's letter paper for sale left over. Yeah.
So, see, it was you were smart to keep all that because it's a gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, well, a few sheets, whatever. But I have other things that I mostly that I've sold that had autographs or whatever on them.
Right. But if only you had the 3-foot model of the Enterprise.
Well, there you go. Some idiot was trying to sell it for $1,000. Yeah,
well, we'll see how that goes. It's an interesting story, and I'm not sure I believe the people involved at this point.
I have no idea what it is.
Yeah,
somebody's basement.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Great talking to you,
Susan, and I would appreciate you being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Darren.
Take care.
It was fun. Thanks.
Awesome. And we're back. It's Darren.
That was nice. That was
Ashley
nice.
Ashley and Mark. I thought so. I really love that Starlog column. You must remember that Starlog column.
Of course. Of course. Every month. Yeah. That was the point that I had, you know, a monthly subscription.
And, me too.
I ate it up.
Yep.
Remember, they would always like run an illustration or a picture of the sets under construction. And it was always like, oh my God.
It was magical.
You know, like, and for a while, it's like it was like a ping pong ball. It was like it's a TV series, it's a movie, it's right. a TV series, it's a, and you know, like is this thing ever going to happen? And then you know she would update on a monthly basis, like what was going on with the motion picture. And you know the one thing we didn't talk to her about, which I'm amazed that we didn't, was her cameo in Star Trek: right. Motion Picture.
Yeah, she's right, almost dead center in the rec deck scene, you know. She was among the 400 crew members, men and women and aliens. And
Trek fans.
And Trek fans, absolutely.
That was an amazing thank you by Gene to the fans when you think about that.
To be fair, it's a little bit of a thank you, but it's also a good way to get free extras.
Look, absolutely. But I think giving you know David Gerald and Susan and so many of the people – like to me, I had a problem like giving John Povel's wife a speaking role, right?
Well, she wasn't his wife at the time.
Yeah, but she was the assistant to Harold Livingston,
yeah.
right? Like I don't think you should be giving roles for actors as a favor to people,
right.
you know? But the people that work for you as a reward, but like giving them extra work is fine, you know? And I think, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know how you guys feel about this, but when they name the ships after people who worked on the show,
right.
like I am such a stickler for canon that I hate when they name ships after, I mean, this is like deep dive geekiness.
You mean you hated the Shuttle Adjustment?
Yeah. Like I don't like when they name it after people who worked on the show. I want it to be completely in canon.
Right.
Like
I can understand that point of view. I don't mind it as much as you do, but.
Well, what I find weird about it is there are certain names that you just can't name check, right? So it's kind of like naming an aircraft carrier, like, you know, after a president, right? After John F. Kennedy or Eisenhower, but like, what if you couldn't name Eisenhower or Kennedy because like it would take people out of it? So you have to name it after the Secretary of Education or some shit. Not that that right. existed like during Kennedy and Eisenhower. So you don't get the USS Roddenberry or the USS Kuhn. You know,
I mean? I served on the USS Bob T. Phillips.
What?
Here comes the fry burger.
Oh, it blew up all by itself.
It's a garbage scow.
It's like, congratulations to Captain Dunsel.
That's right. I understand your point of view. Luckily, it didn't happen very often.
No, it happens more now where, you know, they name it after people. And I understand, like, they named the ship after Aaron Eisenberg, which is really, you know, it's sweet because the honor and memory of someone that we all, you know, had so much respect and admiration for. But I mean, even like on the plaques where they put, you know, the names of the people that worked on the sets, it's like, I'm such a stickler for canon, you know, that I just like it to be completely in universe. But, well, you know,
that's usually the only recognition that a lot of these people ever get. So,
yeah, I know. I just like,
I speak as someone who never was able to get on a plaque. So,
but it was,
there's not even a plaque.
It's not even a plaque. To, yeah.
Mo Green.
This is the business we've chosen.
Yeah, no, but you know, I think, you know, Susan was such an important part of Star Trek. And you could get the sense that, you know, she felt, you know, it was a time where she was making a genuine creative collaboration, you know, and which wasn't acknowledged. And, you know, Gene wasn't really willing to acknowledge. I mean, that was the first time, to be honest, I heard her say that she was the one who said it should be no one and not no man, where no one has gone before. I hadn't heard that before.
Me either.
So that's really interesting. But it's not surprising to hear that a woman would seize on the fact that perhaps it's time, because of course I understand what he's saying. Mankind,
right?
He's, you know, where no man has gone before, it means mankind. Yeah. But I think it was a good decision.
Understand? Yeah.
The
sentiment
no
is
one.
Understandable. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. But know. You know what? What difference would it make? I mean, mankind is mankind.
a lot of interesting things. And of course, if you want to know more about Susan, you can go to Inside Trek and her eBay store, where you can purchase a lot of her autographed scripts and books, and of course her memoir, My Secret Life with Star Trek's creator Gene Roddenberry.
Indeed.
Yeah. Gene, what did you think of Susan, working with Susan?
Well, she was wonderful, and she would always lend a hand whenever necessary. And she was, you know, it was a great, great association, and I'm happy to have had her working for me.
Thank you, Gene. Always good to have you join us on the Trexperts with a few insights that we wouldn't get otherwise. you know, I got to thank you again. This will be a while since this happened, but we had a lovely dinner last night. A lot of people think these dinners only happen when we're traveling, but thanks to the largesse of Mr. Doctorman, he did not want to allow my birthday to pass without us getting together. We got together with some good fellow Trexperts, Kay Reindel and Mojo Adam Mojo Leibowitz, for some great Italian and at Dantana's. And we had a lovely evening, didn't we, Darren?
Yeah, it was great. It was great. And the food was excellent, but way too much of it. And I had a great time. And it was, you know, cherry Cokes for everybody.
Well, I'm very appreciative. It was a lovely evening. And I know, as painful as it must have been, Darren got me a very special gift. Ashley, you want to know what Darren got me?
What did Darren get you?
He got me an action figure from the black hole of the malevolent robot.
Maximilian.
Yeah.
Oh, I am so jealous.
Yeah. Pretty cool, huh?
That is awesome.
I didn't want it stinking up my place.
Oh, man. Come on.
Maybe this will get him
goes
to
hell and
black
becomes
hole.
The devil.
Yeah.
That's my next Super 8 movie.
I look forward to the margaritas that you're going to make with the Maximilian doll.
Exactly.
Or you can whisk your eggs.
Oh, my gosh. No, this is great. Got to watch where you point those things.
That's for sure.
But anyway, a great welcoming everybody back to the Trekspurs. Thanks for joining us for another all-new episode. Of course, we'll be back next week with an all-new episode. We hope you'll follow us on social, Inglourious Trek, Inglourious Trekspurs, wherever you socialize. And
if you're a socialator.
Yeah, socialator. And Lorette Spang, you can just email us at trekspurs@gmail.com. And of course, rate us 5 stars wherever you listen to podcasts as well. And if you want to subscribe, you can do that at
Trekspurs Plus,
or at the 4:30 movie, and
at Apple Podcasts. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. That's great. You're absolutely right. He passed the quiz.
Rick
Edelman would be proud. until next week, on behalf of Ashley, Darren, and myself, Mark A. Altman, keep on trekking. Ingloriously, of course. Hey, Darren, there's this rumor going around that you got a new podcast.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's Trekspurts adjacent. It's a fun thing. It's called the Weirded Beardos. Yeah, and before you react, it's Kirk Thatcher, our favorite punk on the bus, and myself just talking about stuff.
But I hate him.
You don't hate him.
No, I'm kidding. I'm doing a song from Star Trek 4. I hate you, right?
I berate you.
Oh, yeah. But I don't berate him, and I don't hate him. And if he's involved with you, then I love you.
Well, thanks. And, you know, it's basically just us talking about sort of all things related to our history of working in the industry. You know, together we have like 78 years of experience working in the entertainment biz.
I'm going to have to listen to that. I thought it was about maintaining your beards or something.
It has nothing to do with beards, actually, which is kind of funny. It's fun. We basically hang out for an hour every other week. So come and join us. Look for the Weirded Beardos on Spotify if you just want to hear the audio. And we're actually on YouTube as well, the Weirded Beardos.
Great. Can't wait to check it out.
Thanks.
First, start of the right and straight on till morning.